going to invite you to open your Bibles to Proverbs chapter 15, the chapter where we had our meditation verse for this morning. And as you're turning there, let me just say on a personal note that a lot has changed since I had the joy of speaking with you last year during the Pinter Lectures. The Lord has opened the door and allowed us to do a ministry transition to Michigan. You say, what's big about that? Well, we loved our ministry in Virginia Beach at Colonial Baptist Church and at Virginia Beach Theological Seminary for the past 11 years, but the Lord has allowed us to go home. You see, my wife and I are both from Michigan. I was born in Detroit, and both of us lived there. She was from the Flint area, and we lived there until we were 18. Didn't know each other till we went to college. And since 1985, Michigan's just been a place where I visited. And after 31 years, Calvary Baptist Church asked us to come be their next pastor, and it was a great joy. We've been there about 6 months now and are having a great time getting our feet under us in our new ministry. I'm still involved in Virginia Beach. I'm actually teaching a class there next month and have great connections there still. So it's been great. You say, what's it like? Well, I've exchanged the salt water of the ocean for the fresh water of Michigan. We're salt-free. I've exchanged the sharks from Virginia Beach for the largemouth bass of Michigan. I've exchanged, if you broaden the Virginia Beach Eastern Seaboard area to include D.C., I've exchanged the absolute amazing violence of the D.C. area for the peaceful streets of Detroit. It's been wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. And, of course, I've had to leave behind. I no longer live in the shadow of the Carolina Panthers or the Washington Redskins. I have my beloved Detroit Lions back. And we're just awful, okay? But that's my team. That's my team. I stand with them. As a Detroit Lions fan for now, well, I'm 50 years old now, so all my life that I can remember, it's been a long football disappointment life, but that's my team. The last person you would expect to share with you a quote from a Green Bay Packers coach would be me. But I happen to like Vince Lombardi. Always have. I've enjoyed his words of wisdom. He passed away in 1970, but a lot of his words of wisdom stay with us, his leadership principles. And I love when he wrote these words. Listen to this. Teamwork is what made the Green Bay Packers everything they were. They didn't do it for individual glory. They did it because they loved one another. That's a little mushy for football talk, isn't it? He continues, individual commitment to a group effort, that is what makes a team work, a company work, a society work, and a civilization work. I just love that. I not only love his wisdom in general, but I love what he has to say about the importance of teamwork. Now, in Christian circles, when we're talking about teamwork, we use a different word more often. It's the word community. And just as much as I like to hear Lombardi talk about teamwork, I love, in Christian circles, in circles of the local church, I love talking about community. You say, why do you like that? Why do you like to talk about Christians working together and Christians moving together and forming a unit and speaking truth into each other's lives all the time? Why do you like that? I don't know. I jotted down a few reasons. This isn't the message, but a big reason I love this talk is because of you. In this student body, I think the history books will reveal, you had the closing of one generation in the beginning of the next. You had in this student body now, in these 4 years, Gen X is going to be graduating. Your Gen X are about, your millennials are your upperclassmen now, and Gen Z are the underclassmen and the visitors that will be here for Impact. And I love studying generations like that. And one of the hallmarks of your generation, whether you're Gen Y or Gen Z, is that you're into this community thing. You're into looking out for each other. You're into a group loyalty. And you, your young generation, has forced my generation, Gen X and older, to stand up and listen and take note. We haven't been talking about community as much as we should have been the last couple decades. And because of you, we are now. Maybe that's why I like talking about community in the church. Maybe it's because it's so popular right now in evangelical and fundamental circles to talk about community and have study guides and small groups. Maybe it's because of the over 30 times in the New Testament we see the phrase one another and our obligation to one another as believers. Maybe it's because I'm a little bit into biblical counseling, and I view biblical counseling as a temporary small group, a temporary intensive community, if you will. Maybe that's why I like community. Maybe it's because Jesus prayed in John 17, "Neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word, that they all may be one. As thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me." I can read you over and over in the New Testament admonitions for us to be one, for us to have community. But you know, I discover something. As I talk about community, and community is give and take. Community is you being willing to go to someone and you being willing for someone to come to you if there's concerns. I find this truth. We buy into the community and even the confronter stuff, but we don't like being the confronted. See, what do you mean by that? Well, we like getting together. We like the small groups. We like the praying. We love the singing. And I love all of that. And we might even hear a message on why we need to be willing to go to another believer if there's a concern. And we're like, well, that's awkward, but I'm willing to do that. The Bible says to do that. Those two fall pretty quickly in line in our thinking and in our conversations in our Christian circles. But when it comes to being the confrontee, when it comes to being the one that someone is approaching out of concern, we don't like that. We're not as fast to dial in on that one as we are on the first two. See, what are you talking about? Well, I'm talking about someone sees something in your family and there's a spiritual concern. They're legitimately concerned. Maybe it's your marriage if you're married. Maybe it's the ministry you're involved in. Maybe it's the classroom or the dorm. Maybe it's in your church. These are the contexts that we can be confronted. You say, well, what do people come to us about in those contexts? They might be coming to you about an issue of sin, not preferences, not a difference in preferences, but legitimate sin. Or they could be coming to you out of a concern for doctrine. They could be coming to you out of a concern for how you might be going on a Christian liberty burnout. Or they might be coming to you because your testimony is going down in flames. We don't like that. We don't like it when people come to us. And we understand the community thing, but it has boundaries. We don't like it when people are coming to us. So we have to ask the question, why? Why don't we like when people lovingly come to us in the spirit of the gospel expressing concern? And I've heard a lot of these in counseling, but I didn't have to look at what counselees have told me. I just have to look at my own heart. You see, we don't like it because, first of all, the person coming to us may have less than a perfect confrontation going down. In other words, this is how this one sounds. Ah, yeah, someone came to me out of concern, but they didn't follow Matthew 18 perfectly. And now I'm getting a little smug because I've mastered Matthew 18 and I'm starting to preach it. And this becomes my reason not to listen to their confrontation. Well, hey, they didn't do Matthew 18 picture perfectly. So it's a less than perfect confrontation. I don't need to listen to them. What's another reason we don't like being confronted? Well, it could be a less than perfect PowerPoint. No, a less than perfect confronter. You know what this one is, right? This is someone who says, yeah, they came to me out of concern, but I'm just going to tell you a few things. The manner in which they came to me was, well, they were talking down to me. They weren't giving me any respect with how they were talking to me. I deserve a better tone than what I got, or I deserve them, the confronter, to have a different demeanor when they come to me out of concern. And suddenly we start parsing out the manner of their approach, and we say, so, I don't have to listen to them. There's another reason we don't like to be confronted. And it's because what we'll call a less than perfect facts. You know this one, right? This is when someone comes to you and you suddenly go into lawyer mode. You open the lawyer app on your smartphone and you start dissecting the words and the facts of the confrontation. Well, you said there were three, there were actually two. You said it involved George, no, it was Bob. You said it happened on a Monday, it was actually a Friday. And we start parsing the details only to give us an opportunity to turn away and say, I don't need to listen to you, you don't have all the facts right. I mean, of course, we forget that they have the crucial ones right. It could be because less than perfect timing, we're like, really? Someone comes to you and they're expressing concern, they're doing it lovingly, and in the back of our minds, we're like, really, right now? Don't you understand this is exam week? Don't you understand I just went through a breakup? Don't you understand? Don't you understand? I don't have to listen to you. The timing isn't good. But then there's one more reason. A less than perfect consistency. Now be careful with this one. Someone comes to you and they're expressing concern in a gospel tone. They're expressing concern in your life over sin or doctrine, wrong doctrine or something. And you either look to them or you tell others, you know, who are they to come to me? I mean, I know that they're not perfect. I could write a story about their life just in the last 12 months and it won't be pretty. Who are they, as imperfect as they are, to come to me and share this concern? We don't like being confronted. I don't know how those five ring with you. But with the echo of these five in your mind, I want you now to look at Proverbs chapter 15. Proverbs chapter 15, and begin reading at verse 31. Follow along as I read. The ear that heareth the reproof of life abideth among the wise. He that refuseth instruction despiseth his own soul. But he that heareth reproof getteth understanding. The fear of the Lord is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor is humility. You say, okay, let's just lay it out there. When someone comes to us, it is a high-risk situation. Yes. When someone lovingly breaks that awkward barrier, that social barrier, they cross over that, denying themselves out of love for you, out of concern for you, and they say, look, I'm concerned about something I'm seeing in your life. As a brother or sister in Christ, I'm just coming in to make sure I have all the facts. Maybe I don't have all the facts, but I love you enough to come to you. See, that's a risky situation. It is. It is a high-risk situation. But I want you to note something. The risk is not ultimately with the one doing the confronting, see. According to these three verses, the risk is in your response. As you look at those three verses, do you see what you stand to lose if you're not approachable when someone comes to you? You stand to lose life, wisdom, understanding, humility, and honor. Yeah, it's a high-risk moment when this happens in your life because of what you might lose. One of my favorite commentators on Proverbs is Tremper Longman, and he writes about this verse, a very insightful sentence. He says, only the wise are willing to admit mistakes and change behavior and improve their lives. So here's my question for you this morning. How do you listen? Or we could call it this. Are you approachable? I know Gen Y and Gen Z, especially Gen Y, has helped craft a huge part of our Christian vocabulary. We want to be gospel-centered. We want to be gospel-driven. We want to be a gospel people. We want to enjoy gospel community. And I'm not fussing at that wording at all. I think people were talking like that without those words prior to your generation. But you have forced us into the forefront, and I think it's a good conversation to have. But as gospel people, when someone comes to you out of concern, are you approachable? Now, my preference whenever I stand in front of you in chapel is I'd rather just push through one verse or one text, one paragraph, and do exposition. That's my preference. But for the rest of chapel this morning, I want to just sit with you across the coffee table, and I want to be a pastor to you. I want to be a counselor to you, if you will. You've just come to me, and you are bothered that another believer has approached you out of concern. What would I say to you? What I would say to you is this: since we're probably having the greatest coffee in the world, that means we're sitting where? In Dunkin' Donuts. Okay? And I would take a Dunkin'. Don't do the Starbucks thing with me, okay? I'm going to tell you at Dunkin' Donuts, get the Dunkin' Donuts napkin out, get a pen out, and I want you to write down 6 points and 6 passages as you evaluate this person who's approaching you right now. All right? And by the way, these 6 points are really 6 questions. 6 questions and 6 texts. Each question demands a yes or no answer. Question number one. Let me get to the right PowerPoint here. Question number one. Is it possible in this moment that, number one, this moment of confrontation, is it possible that Christ has ordained the timing? Is it possible in this moment of confrontation that Christ has ordained the timing? Now, I want you to go with me to a very familiar text, Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. You know this verse very well. You've memorized it. Verse 28. This is your text for this one. This and Ephesians 1:11. Romans 8:28 says, "We know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to His purpose." See, what's this verse teaching? That God is totally in control of every circumstance of your life and wastes none of them in His effort to make you more like Christ. Remember Ephesians 1:11? Ephesians 1:11 says, "He, God, worketh all things after the counsel of His will." Or how about that guy in the Old Testament, Nebuchadnezzar? In Daniel chapter 4, verse 35, these words come off his lips after he's learned his lesson. Quote, "He, God, doeth according to His will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay His hand or say unto Him, What doest thou?" God does what He wants, when He wants. It's always good, and it's always for your Christ-likeness. That's why I love it when A.W. Tozer writes these words: "God's sovereignty is the attribute by which He rules His entire creation. And to be sovereign," I love this, "God must be all-knowing, all-powerful," and listen to this last phrase, "and absolutely free." Christ is sovereign. And in His perfect sovereignty and His plan and details of your life, He sends messengers into your life. I'm reminded of Proverbs chapter 25, verse 13, "As the cold of snow in the time of harvest, so is a faithful messenger to them that send him. He refresheth the soul of his masters." A faithful messenger is praised in that proverb. So I have a question for you. This believer has stepped into your life, and they have lovingly asked some questions, expressed concern to you, and you got miffed because of the timing. So here's the first question. Is it even possible in this moment of confrontation that Christ has ordained the timing? You only have 2 choices for an answer, yes or no. What's the answer to this one? Yes, it's possible. That's an understatement. Just think about it. Was confrontation convenient timing for King David when in the throne room Nathan confronts him? Was that convenient timing? How about when Peter and Paul are eating with Gentiles and the Christian leaders from Jerusalem show up and Peter withdraws in front of everyone? And in front of everyone, Paul confronts Peter. Was that convenient timing? What about after Peter gives the greatest expression of Christ and his true identity? A few moments later, Jesus says in front of the other disciples to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." Was that really convenient timing? I mean, can't we do that privately? I think you see where I'm going with this. Is it possible in this moment of confrontation that Christ has ordained the time? And the answer is yes. Well, number two, a second question. Is it possible in this moment that Christ uses imperfect messengers? Is it possible in this moment that Christ uses imperfect messengers? What do you think the answer to this one is? Yes. I want you to turn with me to Numbers chapter 22 for this one. Numbers chapter 22. You were probably just there in your devotions this morning, so go back to where you were reading, right? In Numbers chapter 22. Now, as soon as you get there and you start looking at the headings, you're like, really? You're going to come here for this point? Hang with me for a moment. You know, Balak has been trying to, or has hired Balaam to come and curse God's people so that the people of Moab will survive. And Balaam says, I'm not going to go. I'm not going to do it. I'm only going to speak what God says. And finally, God says, go, and he goes, but he goes with the wrong motives. Look at verse 22. And God's anger was kindled because he went. And the angel of the Lord stood in the way for an adversary against him. Now he was riding upon his ass, and his two servants were with him. And the ass saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way, and his sword drawn in his hand. And the ass turned aside out of the way, and went into the field, and Balaam smote the ass to turn her into the way. But the angel of the Lord stood in a path of the vineyard, a wall being on this side and a wall on that side. And when the ass saw the angel of the Lord, she thrust herself into the wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall, and he smote her again. And the angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right hand or to the left. And when the ass saw the angel of the Lord, she fell down under Balaam, and Balaam's anger was kindled, and he smote the ass with a staff. You know, there are some scenes in the Bible I'm going to ask for a replay on in heaven. What would this look like? You have a ticked off prophet. You have a really confused donkey. And then verse 28 happens. And the Lord opened the mouth of the ass, and he said to Balaam, "What have I done unto thee that thou hast smitten me these three times?" What was Balaam's response to that? "You're talking to me. You have a voice. You're putting nouns and verbs together." That should have been shock. And just as I get over the shock of verse 28, I have another shock in verse 29. And Balaam said unto the ass, "Because thou hast mocked me, if there was a sword in mine hand, I would now have killed thee." If you're not surprised that the donkey's talking, be more shocked that he's talking back to it. It says, the Lord opened not only the eyes of the donkey, but he opens the eyes of Balaam, and he sees the angel of the Lord standing in front of him. And while the last we saw the donkey was out flat, and now the prophet's down flat as well, next to the donkey, in the presence of the angel of the Lord. It's an amazing scene, if you think about it. You say, you're really going to use this for the second question, huh? Yes, because Peter uses it this way. Listen. 2 Peter 2:16, Balaam was rebuked for his iniquity. The mute donkey, speaking with man's voice, forbade or restrained the madness of the prophet. You know, sometimes God uses imperfect messengers in our lives. He can use a donkey in Balaam's life. He used Saul, King Saul, to rebuke the enemies of the children of Israel. He used wicked Joab twice to reprove King David. We can't always choose who confronts us. Now, of course, I have to do a knife illustration, right? When I left Virginia Beach, Colonial Baptist Church, the pastoral staff there went in and on a gift for me, and they bought me a $200 Benchmade knife for my collection, a Benchmade Striker knife. And it's a large knife, more of a military type. It's not the kind you want to open the mail with or, you know, in the office. It's a $200 knife. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Now, let's say I had that with me here today, and it was dull. I promise what I'm not going to do. I'm not going to go to the New River Gorge and find a rough rock on the shore and sharpen this $200 Benchmade knife on it. You say, well, couldn't you get it sharp with a rough rock? I could. I could hold the angle, and it could sharpen it, but it's also going to mar a beautiful, expensive blade. I would rather wait till I get back to Detroit and use a Lansky sharpening system I have. I want to sharpen my stuff on the nice hardware, even though the rock would work. You know, when it comes to confrontation, all of us wish that if we had to be confronted for sin, we wish it would be John Piper that would confront us. We wish it would be Dr. Anderson. We wish it would be Elise Fitzpatrick. We just wish that Matt Chandler or one of these people would be the one to come to us. Because, well, they're perfect. And they're great speakers, and they don't tuck their shirt in. Okay? And Dr. Anderson does, but the rest don't. You know, we'd like to say, yeah, I don't mind being confronted if it's this person or that person. Listen, is it possible in this moment that Christ uses imperfect messengers? What's the answer to that? Yes. Actually, he's used you before. And who is perfect? Well, quickly, let's do the rest of these. Is it possible in this moment that Christ is showing me where I am blind? Is it possible? Is it even possible in this moment that Christ is showing me where I am blind? Your text for this is Matthew 7, 3 through 5. It's in the Sermon on the Mount, the last chapter of the Sermon on the Mount. You remember these words. Why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, the log, or the speck, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Or how wilt thou say to thy brother, let me pull out the mote out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in your own eye. Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast the mote out of thy brother's eye. Simple principle here. It's very possible that I might be the one going around to other people trying to be spiritual, trying to be helpful, but in doing so, I realize that I'm blind to a sin in my own life, and someone's loving me enough to come to me and say, you know, you've got a telephone pole hanging out your head. Is it possible that Christ is using this person to show me where I am blind in an area of sin or doctrine or Christian liberty or my testimony? Dewey Bertolini, who oversaw the youth ministry major at the Master's College for years, wrote these words, "Criticism reveals our blind spots. You have yours and I have mine. Areas of deficiency, listen to this, that are visible to everyone except us." Is it possible in this moment that Christ is showing you where I'm blind? Number four, is it possible in this moment that Christ, listen, is testing my reaction more than the charges? For this, I want you to look at James chapter 3. James chapter 3. James 3 talks about the wisdom from above and the wisdom from below. Verse 13, "Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works in the meekness of wisdom. But if ye have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descendeth not from above, but instead is earthly and sensual and devilish. And where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. But the wisdom from above is first pure and peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. There are two types of wisdoms, James is saying. There's a wisdom that is right, and there's a wisdom that is wrong. Problem is, all of us always think we have the wisdom that's what? Right. That's right. And what James is, I believe, teaching here is, it's possible to even be right and still be wrong. You can be holding to a good position, but reacting in a sinful way. Is it possible in this moment of confrontation that Christ is testing my reaction more than the charges? What this person's coming to me over is really not a spiritual issue, but the very fact that they're coming to me, I go off. You could talk about the mother of all bombs. That's you. Either you blow up or you clam up. Is Christ testing my reaction more than the charges? Fred Mitchell writes, it does not matter what happens to us, but our reaction to what happens to us, that's what's important. And there's truth in all criticism, right? I mean, there's gold and dirt. Maybe we have an opportunity in front of us to model the right response and kill my pride. Number five, is it possible in this moment that Christ is exposing a functional idol? And stay on the same page, James 4, 1 through 3. From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence even of your lust that war in your members? Ye lust and have not, ye kill and ye desire to have and cannot obtain. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not, because ye ask not. And then you ask and receive not, because you ask amiss, that ye may consume it upon your lust. You adulterers and adulteresses. What is this? I get angry, I get ticked off whenever I don't get what I want, or I fear I might lose what I love. That always fuels anger. And it always reveals that I'm worshiping. You understand, every time we're angry, we're worshiping. And if I'm worshiping anything other than Christ, if I'm looking for my joy and contentment in anything or anyone else other than Christ, that is revealing a functional idol in my life. And by the way, the more you react to this confrontation, the greater the probability that issue's number five. Well, one more question we have to finish. Is it possible in this moment that Christ is preparing me to pursue others? Is it possible in this moment of confrontation that Christ is preparing me to pursue others? Your text here is Galatians 6:1. You know this text as well. You learned this way back in Awanas. Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such an one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted. Hey, whenever you go to someone else, you need to go in a spirit of humility, because you might be the next one that needs to be confronted. Some people do that well, learn from them. Some people do it terribly, learn from them. Whether this person coming into your life is doing it in a good way or a bad way, learn from them for when it's your turn to pursue someone. So you have six questions written out on that Dunkin' Donuts napkin. Is it possible in this moment that Christ has ordained the timing, that Christ uses imperfect messengers, that Christ is showing me where I am blind? Is it possible that Christ is testing my reaction more than the charges? Is it possible that Christ is exposing functional idols? And is it possible that Christ is preparing me to pursue others? And what's the answer to all of these? Yes. So you know what I'm going to tell you at our coffee? I'm going to say, finish the coffee, keep that napkin, those six verses are your six devotions next 6 days, and go back to the person and ask their forgiveness for your reacting to their effort at love. Speak to them in the language of these six questions. Run to the gospel and thank Jesus for the fact that people like this are in your life, perfect and imperfect, as tools in His hand to make you more like Him. You stay there, and you learn, and you benefit, and you progress because of not only this confrontation, but any other confrontation. I finish with this quote from Paul Tripp and Tim Lane. What is the point of all this? God's work of change has relationships at the core. They are a necessary means and a wonderful goal. Humble community is not the icing on the cake of the Christian life. In a real way, it is the cake. Relationships of love are a means of personal growth, a mark of God's people being purified, and a clear argument to the world for the truth of the gospel.